Hello and welcome to the Customer Insight Leader Podcast. Data, analytics, big data science, machine learning, customer insight, behavioral science, blockchain, data ops, data engineering, agile working. Phew, too many terms, too many things to think about. Do you as a leader need somewhere to turn? To hear what other leaders are doing? To hear what really makes a difference in your business? Welcome. The Customer Insight Leader Podcast is here for you. Each episode, we'll be interviewing a different leader in the fields of customer insight, data, and analytics to hear what they really do, what really makes a difference. So settle down, get that cup of coffee, and enjoy the Customer Insight Leader Podcast. Hello and welcome back to Season 2 of the Customer Insight Leader Podcast, a place to hear from today's leaders in the fields of data, customer insight, data science, and analytics. As I shared in the preview episode for this season, this time we're going to be digging a little bit deeper into some of those all-important softer skills. That's a theme for this season, but more importantly, I'm your host, Paul Loughlin, and with me today is John Conway. John has worked in marketing analytics since the early 2000s, which certainly was an exciting time for data-driven marketeers, lots of new data and new channels being created all the time. He went on to work in loyalty and big data before latterly becoming an independent consultant. His current projects include personal assignments, advisory positions, running a data studio company, as well as being the MD and co-founder of Iota ML, a machine learning platform for marketeers. So, plenty of experience in the world of marketing analytics for us to explore. Welcome, John.
Hi, Paul. Good to be here.
And good to have you with us as well. Good to be back in the rhythm, actually, of this podcast. I've been taking a bit of a break from it, but I will look forward to this conversation immensely. With all my guests, John, I like to crack us off with asking them to tell us their kind of backstory, their career story, if you like, so people know the experience they're drawing on, where they're coming from. So let's keep with that tradition. Please, can you share with us your career journey? How did you grow into the work that you do today?
Right. Well, you've told everybody that I started in the noughties. So really, I got into analytics by accident. I'm not sure if this happens to everybody. I studied general business and was always interested in business. Hmm. And I remember a moment where I was at university and I saw an advert for a job. And the job said, come and work at a desk and be indoors. And the pay was above minimum wage. So this was the criteria. So that was actually RSA Insurance Group. So they were based in my town. And I thought, compared to working in the student bar, this sounds great. So I went there to work whilst at university, worked in a few different departments, and was already enjoying it. You know, what I saw at an insurance company was the product might not always be the most exciting for everybody, but what I saw is a lot of numerical things happening. You know, it's a business where, you know, you don't know how much the product costs to make. So there's lots of analytics around that. There's always lots of staff across the country. So lots of effort in planning, forecasting things. And that's where I fell in. So I was really just working on general insurance things and had a team leader. I did a couple of years, Paul, and ended up saying to a team leader at some point, you know, is there anything I can do here? You know, I'm quite interested in, you know, data analysis and so on. And I was put into a new project, which was the kind of like a workforce management project, if you like. So virtualization, it was called at the time. So instead of all work being routed to offices, it was being controlled by a central support. So I kind of went into this project and it was about rolling out forecast methodology, workforce management tools, new MI reports, and some of these things. So I fell into analytics there. Moved to head office, which was down in Horsham, Sussex, and it went on from there. So I had several roles down at head office. After a few years, I switched to marketing. The trigger for that was actually meeting with the head of the analytics area in marketing. And the part that appealed to me is they described marketing analytics, or that they described the closest relative of marketing analytics being medical science. And I thought this was just a fascinating way of looking at it. So they were really describing experimentation. So this is like mid-noughties at this point. RSA Group had a bunch of brands. More Than was the direct brand, and we were doing a lot of multi-channel marketing. So the insurance industry had moved from being brand based, you know, how your dad would say, look through the yellow pages and they'd be full of ads.
Yeah.
Well, insurance industry had become a direct marketing business. So, you know, generating data from quotations and so on meant there was this data asset. So, you know, into marketing where there's lots of telemarketing, direct mail, there was email was an emerging channel then. So like, how do we make this work using some of the data that we have? And it kind of blew up from there. And in the end, RSA was one of the biggest consumers of third-party data sets. So I got to learn all about that side of it. And it's all targeting. So I was working on segmentation projects, predictive analytics projects. And it was just about the right level of role for me. So I'd moved over from being more like working hands-on with data in building forecast tools in Excel and these sorts of things to real programming. It was SaaS programming then, was the big platform. So I had the right combination of things, a good opportunity. You know, RSA was supportive in things like training you. So I was able to take trainings from the company in a team that was, you know, the interest in that team was growing. And I was young, free and single. So I was able to do things like, you know, in the old days, we had to buy SaaS books for £80 a time or £50. But, you know, I'd read those cover to cover. I was convinced if I was the best programmer in the company, I would really get somewhere. Now, I'm never sure I was the best programmer.
But you tried.
I was able to spend that extra time, you know, really immersing myself in it. And so it went on and on. I became team lead, became responsible for, you know, data-driven channels, marketing. We began to in-house certain things into RSA, media effectiveness. So we began to take in-house tools or even, you know, usually that was something an agency would do. We began to take different softwares to help us do more analytics in-house.
Yep.
And then it was probably the end of the road at RSA. I'd been there 11 years and really just decided that I needed a change. And the change that I chose was to go on to moneysupermarket.com. So, you know, aggregation had become big in financial services. I felt like it was still FS. So I felt like I wasn't moving too far. It was probably a more high profile role. But it was a big digital business. So I began to see both sides of, you know, direct marketing and customer management in a company like that, you know, at a brand doing tens of millions a year in digital marketing spend. So I, you know, began to see digital marketing technologies up close and began to see a data asset unlike one I'd seen before. So I thought RSA had a lot of data. Of course, Money Supermarket, we're working with all the partners in the market, you know, had hundreds of variables on the 20 million consumers in the UK. So, you know, it was really, really rich environment to work in, and just really piqued my interest in doing marketing analytics at scale is what I think I got there. So and I carried on moving. So I ended up being I ended up going to some smaller firms after this, sort of both startups I went to next. Money Supermarket was a lot smaller and more agile. So I'm sure lots of the listeners recognize I've been at a big corporate giant, learned tons, but it took me 11 years to realize that everything just takes a long time. So you find yourself having the same conversations. So moving on to smaller brands, Money Supermarket was like a 400 FTE company. I moved on to a small startup of 10. That was, you know, a big data company around transactional analytics for banks. What I learned there was that selling to a bank is very difficult. So that company actually ran out of road, ran out of money. Yeah. So it took a lot of investment income, but was unable to really launch that platform with banks. And of course, banks want to do it themselves. You know, there's always this, you know, the selling process to a bank is always that there's other parties within the bank that believe they should or could be doing these tasks. But, you know, I got some new exposure there. So a bit like before, what I chose to do having left, you know, transactional banking platform is just, and this wasn't thought through, I promise, but I actually just went to the leader in that space, which was a brand called Cardlytics, who had just launched in the UK.
Yes.
So they were a data monetization company. They were doing great in the US. So signing over 1,000 banks by the time I joined. So the fragmented style of the US banking market meant that you have lots of small banks.
Yes.
You know, the UK at the time had like 5 banks plus a few pseudo banks. And the, you know, the last bank to get a banking license was like in year 1802 or something like that. So, you know, a new bank entrant coming in, I think Metro was the last one, but, you know, it was very difficult. And in the US, you know, each state has different, you know, regulations and things around financial services. So Cardlytics benefited from that by quickly scaling up, signing up customers. And the idea there is that they partner with banks, they power the customer rewards programs attached to bank accounts, but they had the large insight offering on the other side of it. So that was, you know, working with brands to help them get insights they couldn't get before. So if you imagine big retail brands, you never really know your customers. Cardlytics had this data source representing all of UK, most of US, and we'd be able to produce loyalty studies and insight studies to understand the competitive picture for particular brands. And, you know, this was really one of the most pivotal periods of learning I had, because this brand was doing insight studies for every industry vertical. So what happened there was that it saved me having to go and work in every industry vertical to get those insights. So I would work with the senior marketers at those brands, talking about their challenges. And what I got from there is, it was an American, a Cardlytics American company, you know, the American dream, very sales focused, unlike any, a sales focus unlike anything I'd seen, to be honest, in the UK. So we spent a large amount of time on what we call solution selling, which had this kind of construct of, you know, customers and partners have these needs, problems and goals. And our job was to reverse engineer, you know, what it was they were looking for so that our solution was best placed. It sounds so simple now, but when you work for technology or solutions companies, you can be a bit product oriented by accident. So you're very keen to tell everybody what your product does, and, you know, not really spend time understanding what the customer's trying to achieve. And this is a, this would be an example of a sales call that would not go so well. But we were really practicing a lot. And practicing probably is too small a statement. You know, I was tasked with personally working with accounts and, you know, external customers, but also tasked with training the company in really data analytics. So my job there was kind of running the analytics division, but running these data literacy programs to make sure that everybody from, you know, financial admin to the CEO were seeing the same analytics, we're seeing the unique output that our transactional data could create. And, you know, my boss forced me to do it again and again and again. And I'll talk some more about this later. So, you know, it was a, you know, a massive learning experience in that regard. So, so that's, it was my last permanent role. So what happened after that is I actually got married and took a long honeymoon, and decided to become a consultant. So
on honeymoon.
Well, really it was, maybe listeners will recognize this. The decision for that came at Clapham Junction one night, really late. My trains had been late consistently. It was freezing cold. You know, I was working a lot in the office and just decided that I was, you know, coming home to my wife to be, to spend only 2 minutes with her before I would leave on the 6:17 a.m. from Horsham, disappear for another 12 hours. So I actually just felt like, you know, I had enough permanent employment, and I wonder if there's a different way to, you know, still have these types of projects, but on a way that maybe suited me. So I didn't have a plan for becoming a consultant, but just got lucky. So I just worked with people in my network. I got a few early opportunities. The freelancers out there in the world will know these ones where you get a, you know, 3 month engagement, but it's, you know, 2 years later, you're still there. So I had one of these when I started. And then what began to happen is more diversified projects. So, you know, you introduced me as a man with lots going on. That's just, it's just over time. I've begun to have flexibility to take, you know, personal contract work in some industries I've never worked in. So, you know, automotive with Volvo, the United Nations, Eurostar in travel. So exciting brands.
Very diverse,
Yeah, and also just take my own project. So the Data Studio is a small consultancy where we do problem solving. And then lastly, the IOTA project is what we're working on now. So this is about how do we help marketers with machine learning adoption. And the story there was that I'd had a, when I went into loyalty, I had this 7 year gap of not working with the marketers so closely. But when I went back after 7 years, I found myself having these deja vu moments where I was having the same conversations in year 2020 as I was in 2002 when I was back at RSA. So it took me nearly 20 years to realize this. But my conclusion was that, you know, I felt like MarTech was one of the world's hottest industries, but that the marketers had the same problems. So, a lockdown project was to put together a team to sort of build a parallel platform that marketers would use to perform certain machine learning tasks and really make them more agile. What yes. I'm all about is sort of the action end of the scale. So, you know, I would sit and see marketers talk about their objectives, but not attach a solution to the end of their sentence. They'd say, you know, I need to use first party data more, or we're working on product sales, or we're working on personalization. But how do I achieve this? Mm. And that's it. You know, that statement would end with a, you know, question mark. So building some tooling in this space so that my vision was that marketers could go to a meeting with a stakeholder, understand business objective, arrive back at their desk, perform certain tasks, and go back to the stakeholder within a couple of hours. And, you know, stupid example, but if it was, we have to sell more baked beans this week, if the marketer could go back 2 hours later to the trading meeting and say, I've identified, you know, 28,000 customers who would be good targets.
Yeah.
I felt like that was something that would make a marketer look and feel like a rock star and certainly look different to how many of them feel today, where they feel like to use insights, they have to go away, ask somebody else, wait to be a priority, never be a priority. And in the meantime, the business has moved on and it's not about beans anymore. It's about, bread or something like this.
Yes.
So, and this is where we are today then. So multiple projects today, but all very exciting and diverse.
Great. What a great journey, John. As you say, you may have fallen into it and it may not all have been intentional choices, but it seems to have been a really nice varied background. And I think it's good actually that you mentioned what you learned from working in both a large corporate insurer and then still a firm working in the insurance industry, but much more of a scaled direct player like Money Supermarket. I mean, our backgrounds are similar. I benefited so much from the years in Lloyds Bank insurance businesses. And of course, on this podcast, we've had guests Orlando and Harvinder as well from their time at Money Supermarket. And clearly, I think though it can be a non-sexy industry for people out there thinking, where can I cut my teeth in data science, etc. There is a lot of opportunity in the insurance industry, actually. It's well worth people not ignoring. What I'm keen to do, I think, John, is given the different flavour this season of the podcast, thank you for all of that. It's given us a great background as to the foundation of your credibility, if you like, and your experience in this space. Let me prompt you then with our new theme, this focus on softer skills or people skills, if others prefer that language. Clearly, you've developed a lot of technical skill along the way, but I'm sure key to your success as well have been some of these softer skills, some of these people skills. As you look back, which softer skills or people skills would you say you found to be important to your growth and success as a data leader?
I could probably think of two main ones. So, what happened to me and still happens to me is that my customers like me. Well, and they tell me this, it's not me making this up. They tell me they like me because, you know, I'm able to explain things. So they say, you know, I know when we talk about insight analytics and these things, you know, a criteria is often explaining things in a non-technical way to a non-technical audience. If we were doing recruitment, we would be looking for this. So, you know, presentation skills I can pinpoint in every role how I improved upon that. And you know, I mentioned Cardlytics, where it was a B2B brand where I worked with all these different verticals. You know, that role for me was an acid test in so many ways. I already considered myself tenured by the time I took that position. But, you know, you only know what you know. So suddenly thrust into that brand where it's different industry verticals, different brands, different problems. You know, to be able to prepare engaging materials is really something I can see that really stepped up. And in that B2B context, I would say I learned that you know, it's B2B, huh? So in a B2C or when you work for a consumer brand, what you have the opportunity to do is usually have about 5 hours meeting time to discuss any one thing. Yeah. So you'd have a meeting about the meeting, you'd have the meeting itself, and then you'd have the debrief. But these are all lots of opportunities for the analytics person to have multiple attempts at engaging someone either with the data or the idea that you've got. You know, that was really sharpened for me in B2B. You know, you have 30 minutes sometimes in someone's crowded diary.
Yeah.
So I suppose I learned, you know, presentation skills and the art of minimization
is
something I still use today. And really the listening side. So it really sharpened. I believe strongly in the power of listening. And in every one of those roles I talked about, I realized how I sort of learned more and more when to be quiet. I saw more and more how listening would benefit me. The time was not there to be wasted. So I would have back to the B2B context, I would have to listen. I'd have only, you know, minimal time with these people. So it all became this kind of, you know, chess game of how to have a super engaging meeting that was oriented around the next step, which was mutual success for both brands. And I'd have to think about this on the spot during that meeting. So it was a challenge in thinking and engaging in the meeting at the same time. I had to really develop that.
That makes sense. Yeah. And well worth, by the way, I think you highlighting the different challenges and a skill set approach needed really in B2C than B2B. I've heard that from a lot of data leaders and insight leaders who've made that transition. It is a very different market. Okay. I guess I heard quite a few there, John. Thank you for sharing that. So what have I noticed? I've noticed you talk about the translator kind of softer skill, definitely one that often comes up. The importance of presenting and engaging content and that kind of presentation and engagement and communication skill. The minimization, I think you called it, being concise, that was clearly important. And your ability to improvise and think on the spot, and obviously listening, you mentioned as well. All I've seen serve other leaders really well as well, so completely agree as to their importance. If I was to push you, because I'd like to drill down into one of them a little bit more, if I was to push you to prioritize just one, which of those five or so softer skills do you think has probably been most important to you making a difference?
I'm going to pick listening.
Okay.
Because I feel like, it's a single skill, to listen. Yeah. I feel like I would get so many residual benefits from having learned to listen. That I have to put it as number one. So I'll explain a bit more. I talked earlier about, you know, I decided to try and be the best programmer in these things.
Yeah.
This is, you know, insular, huh? I'm focusing on my skills, how to make myself better. And you take that into your next role and you become a bit more trying to think of others because you moved into management or something like this. But you're still keen to, when you're younger, or I certainly was anyway, you're very keen to recommend your solutions. It must be some ego thing, like you're young and you want to sort of show, your idea or your proposed solution to this problem that you've only half listened to. So now that I'm grown, I can recognize moments where I was probably very keen to, you know, recommend. Paul, I probably made every mistake in the book. Huh? So I probably recommended overly complex solutions when simple would do. Yeah. I probably went down a rabbit hole, which created a time pressure. It's how you learn. So I would have done all of those things. But certainly the listening side, what I think I eventually got out of it. And again, I keep going back to Cardlytics because I learned so much there. But you would get, I feel like I would, by allowing the person you're working with good airtime to describe what it is they're looking for, and not interjecting, not recommending solutions too early, and not empathizing. Let me tell you another one I've seen a lot. People are keen to show some empathy as to the problem by describing something similar that happened to them or a similar situation. So, you know, a stakeholder gets halfway through a point and someone is keen to say, aha, it's like in, you know, last year when we had this problem. So the person is trying to show that they recognize what the person is saying. But what's happened in that moment of empathy is it's really derailed the discussion and knocked the stakeholder, of course, from finishing what they're trying to say. So really, you know, I suppose I could call it listening. I also just learned when to be quiet. So I learned that explanations tend to have, it can come in either order. Sometimes it can be a stakeholder will say, you know, I need a technical solution because of this business issue I have. You know, you'd have to listen to both sides. If you started jumping in on the technical side of it immediately, you would have less context because you would have blocked the business issue. And it works vice versa. So, you know, someone is trying to describe the business issue they've got. If you cut into that too soon, you know, they may not complete where they were going with this. And it's the value of the information. So what they might have added, and say, I've got this business issue, and you jump in and say, yeah, I really recognize that. Well, where they might have taken this to is extra information for you.
Yes.
So they might have described the personal relationships that it's affecting for them. So, you know, senior management, you know, I've got this analytical problem. The reason I need it is that the CFO is breathing down my neck. Ah, now some context. Whereas if he jumps straight into, oh, I see your problem. You know, this is very frequent for someone using data. You know, we're going to go off and put that data on the torture rack and come up with something for you. Well, the point here is that they've told you, you know, what you would have missed is that the CFO is in the picture. So suddenly it moves these insight challenges from, you know, what is the data, what's the business thing, to commercial. You know, that would tell me, okay, we switch gears on this from it being a bit too data heavy to we have to talk in pounds and pence here. The CFO is on the scene. So these are just little examples that I would begin to spot, and it's certainly the younger version of myself would have not seen this stuff. But really, just learning to allow people to finish, you know, let them keep talking. The more listening that's happening, the more information gathering you're doing yourself.
Yeah, I completely agree, John. So I'll risk saying that I think both of us are two men who are quite good at talking ourselves. So I find it interesting and encouraging that we've both learned the importance of listening as well. Two things that I'll name drop, actually, a couple of books that you've made me think of listening to you. I think on that whole interruption, meaning you lose the wisdom that was about to come, or the thought process that was there in the person. If people haven't come across an author called Nancy Klein, either her original book, Time to Think, or her, I think, even better sequel, More Time to Think, is well worth a read. It will transform your view of the power of not interrupting people. And I think completely agree with your challenge about solutionizing in order to display empathy. Or unintentionally solutionizing, really. Well worth a look at a book called The Advice Trap by a guy called Michael Bungay-Stanier. That's also very good on that point. So great, John. All that spiel by me is to say I think that's a wise choice. To explore this a bit further, I'd be interested in humanizing it a bit. Did you have a role model who inspired you early on, or demonstrated to you how powerful listening can be? When you think about listening as a skill, is there a person you think of as, they were a very effective listener?
Yeah, there is one. They were effective at asking questions and listening. So it seems like I'm always talking about Carnitics. It was a role where I really learned this a lot. But in every role, I could probably pick somebody. But I would pick a guy called Pat Venker, who was my boss over at Carlytics, and he was very experienced guy. He, you know, was getting close to retirement age and had a 30-year background in agencies, direct, B2B, and all these different pieces of analytics.
I like him already.
Yeah, right. And so Pat would, you know, I didn't see it at the time. So this is the brilliance of it. You know, we would take one-to-one time, and I'm really only describing to the listeners questioning and answering, but you know he would be able to. He had been in my shoes, yeah. So he would ask questions, recognizing either what it was I was dealing with, whether it would be a customer or internal relationship or something like this, and just giving freedom for me to try to answer the question. So he would just have a questioning style that invited commentary, or he might even ask me in quite vague ways as to, you know, what do you think we should do here? And of course, what would happen is I would have to think on my feet. I would have to go through, you know, like a thought process. You would do pros and cons, but I'd do this out loud in front of him. And then I would slowly do a deduction of, you know, ruling out certain cons or ruling in certain pros. And I would sort of end about 5 minutes later. This poor guy had to sit and listen to me. But he'd asked a magic question, and I would end by saying, so, you know, okay, Pat, I've convinced myself. What I would do is do this. And he'd say, oh, that's great. You know, this is what I did in 1987 when I worked for Nielsen. And it's like, oh, wow, right. You know, he underlined his experience in it and that he'd seen it before. But really, this is probably where I would say, when I talked just earlier about, you know, he could have dived in at any moment. He had more than adequate experience and had lived my life at any moment during my one-to-one time with him, where I was kind of answering in a meandering way. He could have tried to bump it back on course, offer the word that I was looking for, or frame something in a certain way. But credit to the guy, he sat there and let me work it through in front of him. So he really was asking challenging questions, letting me get to the answer, small debrief of the process that I'd been through, and then move on to another question. So Paul, I was exhausted after these one-to-ones. It's a bit like being on a therapist's couch.
But
in lots of ways, he helped me see, ultimately what he was doing here was having me put myself in the shoes of the customer. Crazy as it sounds, it's, in working life, you're often consumed by things in front of you. But with his questioning style, was able for me to just describe what the stakeholder was concerned with. And it was just a good enough reminder that it helped me realize, often in analytics, you're seeing technical challenges and you're becoming strangled by them. Coming at it from the customer's standpoint, sometimes you can just see things way easier. You know, he taught me, I'll tell all the listeners, you know, he would work with me because my personality is that I'm not decisive. So he never, only when we parted, did he tell me that we were working on this? But we would, you know, he would ask me to, come to management meetings with a particular answer. He would say, you know, this is going to be in 2 days. Of course, I would say sometimes, you know, I'm not sure that's possible. I think this is too tight. But he taught me this concept of, you know, done is better than perfect, and that the business needs answers and needs assertive leaders to be able to, you know, produce a good enough answer with the data that they have and the time pressure that they have, so that the business can keep moving.
Yes.
And so you know, taught me a bunch of things like this. So how to think of, you know, the consumers of your data. It all sounds so obvious, you know, be customer oriented or think about your stakeholders. But all I will say is, you know, analytics people can tend to be stuck in the technical side or the data side. True. The reason I feel like I validated this as such an important point is when I became a consultant and started to use, I was schooled in it. So I began to behave always this way. I began to be able to, you know, proactively see things from the customer's standpoint much more quickly. And the reason I feel like it was validated is I would work places on consulting assignments where they felt like I walked on water. Because no one had either explained it, you know, a long list of challenges. You know, John, we had BI tools that we never knew how to use. John, no one has ever explained the data to us like that before. John, and so on. And this is why some of the engagements were for 3 months that became 2 years. The feedback was great. I was happy with it. But all I was really doing was utilizing some of those things that he taught me.
That's a great example. It's funny listening to you there. I've noticed I've got a similar example in my own life. So, and it's interesting that you identified this man as very effective questioner, but really that's the proxy for the quality of his listening, was that he was able to hold back those interventions he could have given earlier in order to listen well and hone the questions. And earlier in my career, there was a gent I've actually had on as a guest on this podcast earlier on, William Buist, who was my line manager for a number of years. And I used to always think William's skill was, how does he frame those incredibly effective questions? It's the concise questioning that's the real skill. Over the years, I come to realize it was the quality of the listening, because he listened so well. Then when he came to frame a question, it was a very powerful question. He could again stand back and let me do my own deduction, as you experienced. So I relate a lot to your example, John.
Well, I've got a tip, if it's okay. I've got a tip. You know, we're saying all this, you know, kind of the theoretical learnings and about listening, and that I got it from Pat. So not everyone has the lucky break to work with such a leader. But there's just another way if you're earlier in your career that I would sort of recognize this happening. Of course, it's Cardlytics again. So again, sorry to the listeners. Cardlytics, great place to work. But here's something that strengthened this concept for me. And I think anyone in any business could do it. It's a bit like in a technical sense, in an IT area, you have a retro of, we did a sprint, we did some technical things, and the retro says, was it good or bad? An interesting reflection is that the retro is, IT is one of the few places that a retro exists. You know, in other departments or other areas of business, it's just like, the past is the past. We're moving forwards. We're either doing well or we're screwing up, but we're not sure. And and so it goes on. Now at Cardlytics, being in that sales mode as we were, we would have to exit client meetings and do this kind of retro. We weren't forced to. It's just like a quick recap on how did we all see that meeting. So it's B2B. Okay, so imagine the analyst is going, the account manager is going, a sales lead is going. So probably B2B companies would really recognize this a lot. But I think in any B2C, or if you're working in a big brand, the concept of just trying to debrief certain meetings and certain things with someone who is not your teammate is a hugely valuable way of doing it. And I think, you can do this over coffee. So I don't think there's a large barrier to being able to try and practice, discussing who said what, why do you think they might have said it? Did you pick up a motivation from it? And this is what we were doing in Cardlytics. So we were really doing this, little analytics after the event of, what did we see and hear in that meeting? And were there any, and down to body language, okay? So even noting so-and-so was not engaged, so-and-so was engaged. This was the sales methodology that was coming from that rapidly growing US business, where it was all every bit of sales, from body language to the psychology, the written word, was being looked at really closely. But I think this is something, if you just work in a company, big company, small company, and you wanted to sort of practice getting a new perspective. Someone who's not your teammate discussing what just happened, much like a retro in a IT sprint, would be a way to simulate this.
Great example, John. Thanks for the tip, and hope it helps you, listeners. And I completely agree about the power of retrospectives, and I've recommended them to a number of data science and analytics teams as well, who try and do agile working outside IT and can sometimes leave that bit behind, but it is powerful. We're coming toward the end of our time, John, and it's been great talking with you, but I wonder whether I could push you for one best example where you've seen the biggest benefit of this listening skill. It's clearly something that you've been inspired by. I'll take a wild guess that it might be at Cardlytics, but is there a biggest example where you look back on and you say, oh, thank goodness I listened well. That made all the difference in that situation.
It would not be at Cardlytics.
Oh!
In fact, yeah, this will shock you. So so I can think of an example as a consultant. So
okay.
It's a bit fuzzy in my head. It was all very fast at that time and lots of things going on. But it does underline that an earlier comment that I made. So an earlier comment that I made was, no one's ever shown us to use the tools. So something that can happen in big companies is they're obsessed with self-serve. They try to wish that their business people will self-serve.
Yeah.
I don't know why. It's either the business people become so inspired by using the data that they hit greater heights, or it's just that they need less analysts or can focus the analysts on data science tasks. Whatever the reasons, and BI philosophy is not the topic of this call. But I did work somewhere where this kind of rollout of self-serve and BI tools had happened, and I really recall a meeting where we were going over these things. What insight do we need? What analytics do we need? And it was, towards the end of the meeting, everyone felt a bit frazzled. And I forget who was, I even forget the person who was speaking, but they almost mumbled under their breath at the end of the meeting that no one has ever really shown us how to use this. Yeah. So can imagine, technical departments rolling out, but not doing enough data literacy or hands-on training with the users? Like how would a user know how to build a piece of analytics when, you know, the data that is in front of them, you know, it does not come to them intuitively around what they're looking at? So this was one where it was almost just like a half whisper from some exhausted stakeholder at the end of a requirements gathering. But what I subsequently did is, you know, I go back to Cardlytics now. So, you know, we were doing trainings relentlessly about BI output, the data that we had. So I really just replicated that process and undertook, BI training, data literacy training, and kind of put those things first as, let's do data literacy. Let's try and frame the data according to the business that we have. And then the training on the how do you use the tools can come next. Yes. And having done those things, that's where I got some of this good feedback of, no one had took the initiative for us like that before. But now we're able to do things and simple things. So now we're able to count things. What happened last week? You know, basic insights where people need to build their own decks to manage their departments. Suddenly able to do this instead of feeling overwhelmed. And so it meant that the BI project, you know, would have had an ROI of minus before, but it was, suddenly able to contribute to people's productivity. And it was really just, listening, having heard that point, it completely flipped the challenge for me. Mm-hmm. It was, we've been talking about requirements gathering and what reports do we need and metrics. Mm-hmm. And it was none of those things. It was simply just that, people who were expected to use these systems were not given adequate support. It's a completely different project to metrics and measurement. So again, just a lucky one for me, Paul, that this person whispered that at the end of the meeting.
But good that you noticed. I mean, I think it joins a few dots, actually, John. So thank you for sharing that example. Your whole point about the tip of practice debriefing after a meeting, I guess the precursor of that is you stay present and you notice things during the meeting. And clearly, you weren't just absorbed in metrics and measurement. You were able to keep your ears open, keep your eyes open, and notice that kind of quiet reaction from a stakeholder. And I agree that aspect of listening is really important as well.
Well, I'm a people watcher, actually. So I would watch people in meetings. I would work places I've worked would always say, "Oh no, when John's quiet and he's looking at me, I feel really worried." it's not. What I'm doing is, it's like a muscle memory now. But I will scan a room and check for engagement of participants. If someone there is important to the analytic agenda, like a head of sales is looking bored. Well, it shouldn't be like this. Yeah. Yes. The data that a company has should be one of the driving forces behind the sales process. So we've got an unengaged person. We either need to check ourselves, alter the course of the meeting, or let it conclude, but go about that a different way and try to connect with that person so that they feel their needs are being met.
That's great. It's great. Nice example. And I agree completely. Okay. Coming toward a conclusion, John, I guess in exploring these kind of softer skills, and thank you for your engagement in exploring the importance of this listening skill, I'm keen to put some limits around it as well. Everything's got a shadow side, I guess Jung would say. Is there any kind of health warning here? Any situations you've faced where you think leaders shouldn't be listening? Any examples where you've seen listening like this was not appropriate?
I think of it this way. I've spent 45 minutes encouraging listening and how everyone's opinion is so important because you're data gathering for yourself to make yourself more effective. So I wouldn't pick up one example where it went bad, but I will say, time is precious. So as you become more confident and become more of an expert in your area in data analytics and insight, what you will see is people wanting to kind of repeat what's happened or what's been agreed or what's been said. So you will get, it's like the reverse of the empathy. So you'll get someone want to say it back to you or say it back to an entire meeting. It's the process of them validating their understanding of what's being said. I would say in this space, if someone is going down a rabbit hole or has grasped something incorrectly, it's okay to put the brakes on, raise your hand and put them back on course, because sit there listening. You can show yourself to be a good listener, but if fundamentally someone has not gripped either something that's technical or a business element, that is, you know, fundamental to what you've all been discussing, rein that back. So either, you know, on the data side, it might be, you know, what data do we have for what reason or what's possible. If someone's just misunderstood, you know, what that data is, why it can be used, or if it can even be used at all. If it's, you know, if you sometimes, you know, folk think that all data can be used for all reasons. It's not always true. So if there's something that, you know, someone is speaking and you believe it, you know, that you can just help by steering it slightly or making a quick input. I always just put my hand up like a school kid and people laugh. And they don't feel too upset. Instead of speaking over somebody or something like that, you raise your hand in the air as if you were 10 years old and they'll just laugh and take it in good spirit. So this is my tip.
Nice. I like it. It reminds me, actually, it's funny. It's got a bit of an analogy with the power I've discovered in my own work of mentoring, not just coaching. Coaching can really help leaders, but there are times when it's artificial not to offer the help to that person or correct some misunderstanding from your own experience. Is some of the power that mentoring can offer as coaching plus. So I completely agree, and I love the raised hand tip, John. That's a great one. That's been great. Thank you for your thoughts, John. Many thanks for your time today. As I knew it would be, it's been a genuine pleasure to chat with you.
Great. Thanks for that, Paul. I enjoyed it.
Good. And thank you, everybody, for listening. I hope you found that helpful and continue to listen to the Customer Insight Leader podcast now in season 2. More great interviews coming up. And each week, there's also fresh content on our blog, customerinsightleader.com. So you might want to check that out too, including for some of those book reviews I mentioned. Before then, it just remains for me to once more say thanks to everyone for your time. Have a great week, and perhaps you can reflect on some of what John shared with us. What could be the power of more listening in your role? How could that empower you to better understand, to ask better questions? Something to ruminate on. Bye for now, everyone.